Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for January 25th. Oh my goodness. The month of January almost gone. Will this year be one of those years that just flies by? Anyway, hopefully I'm accomplishing a lot every week. But I just want to make a comment about last week's show, which I started out by talking about. I was actually answering questions from many listeners. Many listeners wrote in, called in, people who had purchased water filters in the past. And so I got this barrage of questions, which is way out of normal. I mean, I get, you know, people call in, ask questions, but this topic hit the nervous system of everybody, it seems. So I got this barrage of calls and emails, etc., asking about plastics in the water. And this article came out dealing with microplastics, that microparticles, particulate matter from plastics that's in the water. And this, of course, comes from bottled water. That's the primary source of this. If you have a plastic bucket at home and you put some water in there, it's not going to have millions of nanoparticles. And I think the plastic that's getting into the water from the water bottles that you buy at the gas station, you know, like the 1 liter, half liter bottle or whatever at the gas station, is because of the way they make plastics now. They've been restricted from using all of these things that made plastic plastic. And also the recycling, I think, because now what happens, plastic, it's recycled, it gets ground up into super fine powder and then recycled into making plastic again. And a lot of that stuff does not form a single cohesive piece. Like we look at a plastic bottle, it looks like it's all one piece, but off of that is shedding all of these nanoparticles. And so anyway, this story comes out a couple weeks ago. It hit the major news media. It's broadcast every place, talking about microparticles, nanoparticles of plastic in the water, and that the numbers they talked about were pretty staggering, that in a like average bottle of water, there are hundreds of thousands of these little microparticles of plastic. And of course, you swash down that bottle of water, that all that plastic goes into your system, and then eventually some of it's gonna, you know, work into your system, into your bloodstream, into your cells, etc. And I think if you drink it, probably your liver, your kidneys, and everything are gonna filter out a lot of this. But that's not good, because now you're loading up these filtering organs in the body with chemicals. But the point of what I'm gonna talk about here. Then I went on to discuss my water filters, and that was what people were calling about. They were called because I'm probably considered somewhat of an expert on cleaning up water and water filtration, because I've been in the water filtration business for 24 years and running, probably more than a lot of major companies. And so anyway, I started out in this discussion of my water filters. Well, that's what people were asking about, so that's what I talked about. So some clown writes in and says, oh, talking commercial about your water filters. You spend too much time. Well, this is what the people asked for. So it's my show. I pay for the airtime, so I get to talk about what I want to talk about. And I get to talk about the things that I consider important, what is on the pulse of people out there. And so I'll just repeat that my filters are the best around. In an imperfect world with imperfect products where nothing is perfect, I probably have the closest to perfect of any water filter products out there. Most people are selling stuff that was, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old. Technologies, and I'm the only one on the planet that has modern filtration products. It's just as simple as that. Okay, well, I'm not going to go through that again, but I'm just telling you why I spent a good deal of time last week on this show talking about that topic. People called in and asked me specifically to talk about that issue, and I'll just also make it clear, you should not be filtering water that comes in plastic bottles. What in the world would you be putting that through a water filter for? You should be getting your water, if you have a water filter, that should be coming from well water, city water, and that's not going to have plastic in it. The articles that you were reading, just to make it very clear, we're dealing with water that comes from bottled water, like especially these thin little plastic bottles that you buy at the gas station. Stop using those. Buy yourself a good water bottle, stainless steel or aluminum, whatever, because the aluminum ones are not going to leach aluminum into your water. They're not going to do that. They're, you know, it's a solid piece of aluminum. But I personally use stainless steel. A long time ago, I sold Clean Canteen, and that's with two K's. Clean is with a K, and Canteen is with a K. And I don't sell them anymore. I used to give them away with water filter products, etc. But that's what I personally use, is a Clean Canteen. And that's I'm not an advertiser for them, but talk about a wonderful product. And there's other stainless steel water bottles like that. But they're kind of a mom and pop shop making these wonderful stainless, in the small ones, tall ones that'll still fit into your car, a cup holder in your car, but they're tall. And then going all the way up to, I think, 40 ounces or something like that. Really world-class product. That's what I personally use. And so I fill my water bottle from my filtered water that's filtered with my filters. That's what I use. And, you know, I'm perking along here, not doing too bad for a guy my age. But a lot of it is because of simply drinking clean water. Filtered water, getting all the chemicals out, etc. I tell this story that, oh, probably 15 years ago, or you can see me, one of the more famous photos of me on the internet. I'm as on the right, that's a double photo. It's me sitting down with a suit on and not a tie, just open neck shirt. And I'm talking, and that's one picture. And then the other picture is me giving a discussion, a talk at the UFO Congress. And there's a Tesla tower up on the screen behind me, and I'm talking. Well, in that picture, you can see me. I'm overweight, probably 60 pounds overweight. I'm balding on the top. My hair is kind of ratty. And, you know, I'm overweight. And if you had a close-up view of my face, my skin complexion was not perfect. I started drinking clean water, and that's the one major thing I did. The other thing I did, by the way, was, I was taking flax. And as I, at the time, I was selling this golden flax. This company out of North Dakota was growing and selling golden flax. It's a much bigger flax seed than the standard brown flax like you buy in a store. And it turned out I was on an airplane. Just tell you this little story. I was on an airplane, and I was sitting there, and I started talking to this woman next to me. And so anyway, we're talking, and I was saying a few things, and she got into some topics. And it got into topics that I was familiar with, the things that I deal with, you know, in my professional life and everything. And so she introduced herself. She said, okay, that's who I am. And I said, well, my name is James McCanny. And she goes, what? You're James McCanny? And she screams on the airplane. She screams out. Her husband was like sitting across the aisle, you know, some other members of her family, I'm not sure. But she screams out. She says, I'm sitting next to James McCanny. And I shuddered because she screamed it so loud. Now everybody on the plane looked around and looked at us. But anyway, a very nice lady. And anyway, because of that chance meeting on the airplane, I contacted them and I started selling their product, the Golden Flax. And so anyway, I personally was taking that and I dropped like 60 pounds. It just, the water, the weight just came off of me like, you know, like nothing. And then also at the same time is when I was in the early days of my water filter business, I'm drinking clean water. Okay, so anyway, It's very important to drink clean water. It's the healthiest thing you can do for yourself, but you have to filter the water. There's really, you know, in my experience, whether it's city water, whether it's well water, whether it's surface water from or a stream that comes through your property and you take the water from there, whatever, rainwater, wherever you get your water from, you got to filter it. And then you've got good water. Okay, so enough of that. Tonight, I want to talk about, there's quite a few topics. Maybe I'll take the smaller ones first here. I saw two interviews with Tucker Carlson. And one of them, he's talking to a scientist, this guy who is probably some NASA hack, something like that. I really didn't see who he was interviewing. But Tucker Carlson, and this is recent interviews, is bringing up the fact that the moon of Saturn, called Titan, it's a big moon. It's, I think it's the biggest moon in the solar system, and it may be bigger than our own moon. I can't remember. I should know that, but I don't offhand. Anyway, Titan has this a massive amount of hydrocarbons, oil, basically oil, on its surface, and it's very cold. And so you have nitrogen compounds also, nitrogen-hydrogen compounds, and then hydrocarbons, oil. Basically, that's what we call naphtha or oil. And he's going, well, how did it get there? Very astute. Tucker's a smart guy. And so he notices this, and he's asking this scientist, but the scientist completely evades the whole question and starts talking about the temperature of Titan and other things. It has nothing to do with the question. And so I want to address the answer to that, and I wish I could get a maybe now that Tucker is away from Fox, I should make an attempt to get on his show and to start talking some sense into the world of science, because there's really not a lot out there. Not many scientists really know much about anything that's going on. They repeat the old hack theories that don't make any sense, and they don't know any better. But anyway, the answer to Tucker's question is that the oil on Titan is like oil on Earth, or oil at any other place in the solar system, on the surface of comets. When we visited comets, there's about a dozen now that we have close-up photograph of the comet nucleus. Some of them are kind of dry, rocky. Some of them have kind of this dust material on the surface. And some of them have baked black hydrocarbon surface, like tar, literally tar, baked on the surface, black. And so anyway, there weren't any dinosaurs and fern forests on this comet nucleus. So where did this tar come from? And the answer is it's a common element in outer space. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, including in our solar system, in our stars, in vacuous space, what we consider the vacuum of outer space. There's a good deal of hydrogen. And, of course, oxygen, carbon atoms, nitrogen atoms, all of these base atoms. And when they get sucked into the comet nucleus, then they in the electric field of the comet nucleus, as this material is being drawn in, these molecules get closer and closer together, and they start forming the potential hump that they have to go over to create the molecules is overcome because of the electric field as they get closer to the comet nucleus, and therefore you get nitrogen hydrogen compounds, ammonias type compounds, to the hydrocarbons, which are all the way down to the benzenes, all up to the long chain hydrocarbons that we call tar, and everything in between, oil, etc., and all of the various variations of hydrocarbons. That is where it comes from, including the oil that we find on planet Earth, because Earth passed through the tail of comets, and it just, the amount of, it's like the Noah's flood, it was the same thing. We passed through the tail of a large comet. It lasted for about a month. The ancients talk about 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain all over the world. The ocean levels of the world rose hundreds of feet. And in that same time, it rained hydrocarbons and all kinds of nitrogen, hydrogen compounds, etc. It all came raining in at the same time from this comet tail, but primarily water, primarily water. So that's where the flood, the great flood of Noah, came from. Okay, because we passed through the tail of a comet. So that's where oil comes from, literally. When the people in the Mideast first started discovering and using oil, it was around 1200 AD. And they noticed pools of oil. And they, what is this? They learned that it burned. You could burn it. You could create a fire. You could extract, by heating it up, you could extract different characteristic chemicals that were in the oil. These would have been the lower chain carbon hydrogen compounds. And they extracted like kerosene, et cetera. They learned how to refine it. And then when it was gone from these pools, of course, they used it for warfare. When they got to the point where they used up all of the oil that was at the surface, they dug down a little bit and they said, doggone it, there's more of this oil stuff down in the ground. So they learned to go down in the ground. Then the whole history of oil exploration, finding oil, getting it out of the ground, the idea of refining gasoline, cracking the big hydrocarbon chains into gasoline where you could put it in a engine, automobiles came about, etc., and the rest is history. Okay, so anyway, back to Tucker Carlson's question, said no, and he said, were there dinosaurs and fern forests repeating this garbage that they teach kids and everybody through PhD level, that somehow the oil comes from dinosaur bones and fern forests? Just absolute garbage. And so anyway, that is the answer to Tucker Carlson's question. Also, I just mentioned, and I don't follow Tucker Carlson, I just happened to see these two videos which struck my interest. The other one, he's interviewing the Surgeon General of Florida, the state of Florida, who is talking about the fact that he made a mandate in the state of Florida to immediately stop any vaccination from the COVID vaccines. And he talked about the evil associated with the vaccines. Very interesting. So, okay. Which brings up the next topic. There's a 32-year-old athlete who dropped over dead a couple days ago. He was a linebacker for the New Orleans Saints. I think he was retired. I believe he was retired. Good physical condition. All of a sudden, one day, he drops over dead. And, of course, they had the eulogy in the paper talking about what a great person, family member, everything he was. But nothing about what he died from. And what do you want to bet? It was myocarditis from the COVID shot. And that's where you see these people who are in perfect physical condition. There's nobody better physical condition than a linebacker in the NFL. Or these people, when they're retired, they stay in very good physical condition. They don't go out and get overweight and drink beer every night. And, you know, no, they're people who lived by conditioning their whole life. So they're staying in very good physical condition, and one day, bam, dead. So anyway, those stories go together, that the Surgeon General of Florida has said no more COVID shots. But also, people are telling me, now I haven't heard these stories myself, but that they're going to try and introduce some new COVID type of thing in May of this year. And, of course, obviously, that'll be intended to disrupt the election, to make everybody, oops. And if you look at the timing of the last one, the same thing. When did it occur? Months before the election. Oh, nobody can go vote. We can't have all these people going to the same voting place. They're all going to kill themselves transmitting COVID. So you have to have mail-in ballots. That's where that's headed, of course. That's the way to fix election is by mail-in ballots. Just quickly, I want to talk about my webpage. Now, it's been many months, really, since my webpage has been together, if you haven't noticed. You know, that's why I always tell people, listen to this show on shortwave. Listen to get yourself a shortwave radio, because there'll be a day when the internet is not going to be there, where it's going to be controlled. And that's going on right now with the control of the, literally the control of the internet. So my webpage, I started an effort. It was probably last August, maybe before, maybe even long before then, to rebuild it into a modern webpage. And I thought, you know, join the 21st century, get a modern webpage, because I was maintaining it myself, literally. And with the old HTML type of, you know, front page, HTML editor. And that was okay, but it was very limited in terms of the sales part of, you know, the, my books. And I had all kinds of problems with the books being online, being the Google crawling thing where they were exposing my books on the internet, giving out the URLs, etc. So I had to stop all that. So I made an effort, and I think probably about October, my new spanking new web page went live. And and this was a modern with, you know, set up with WooCommerce, and that's the biggest thing, is to have a modern marketing tool. That and so anyway, almost right away, my shows started disappearing, and my products started disappearing from the web page. Clearly, somebody was hacking it. And then recently, right before Christmas, the page got royally hacked, and people got into what they thought were the backup files. They really weren't, but just made a giant mess of everything. And I'm still trying to get that back together. One of the big things on the webpage would be my radio archives, the radio archives of my 24 years of doing this radio show. Totally disrupted, etc. And so trying to get this back. Now, imagine, here's a webpage that is probably pushing 20 gigabytes of information along with everything else. And I decided that I did not want the web page to be as big as it was before. So a lot of things I was pulling off and putting into a different format, like in a format of books, etc. And so that's still all under progress. But been fighting this hacking thing that's been going on. And it's not the water filter page. It's not the other pages, etc. It's the my J. McCanney Science webpage. Okay, so anyway, I just wanted to let people know that it should be back online probably this week, and with a whole new ordering system, my education package, a couple of new products that are going to be there, very interesting repackaging, etc., of old products. And so just a heads up, if you've been trying to get my webpage or my radio shows are not there, the archives, just hold your breath a little bit longer, and that all of that will be up. Okay, this topic I breached last week at the end of my show, and I'm going to go into some detail here about what I call the NASA Lunar Surface Credibility Problem. And I'm going to say that again. So it's NASA. Okay, we got NASA. You know who they are. Lunar Surface. Okay, so we all have seen the Apollo lunar landing footage. You know, astronomers running around or driving around in the lunar buggy, whatever they call it, the lunar rover, with the sand flying up behind it, etc. And the astronauts with a big boulder out there taking a picture of them chopping away at this big boulder, getting moon rock samples. Okay, so that's everybody's vision of the lunar surface. And that's really our only view of the lunar surface. Other than the Chinese landed on the far side of the moon, the lander goes off and drives away into the sunset. Same thing, this quarter-inch layer of fine dust on top of some kind of surface that you can't see. Well, that's not what the lunar surface looks like. All of this is warehouse footage of something, and there's no cross-checking any of this. But the the idea that that's somehow what the lunar surface looks like is just absurd, absolutely absurd. The lunar surface would be highly volcanic, the remnants of volcanism. Lava is, there's various types of lava, the Aja lava, the slow-moving lava, the really explosive cinder type of lava where it blows out of a cinder cone volcano and comes, you know, it looks like popcorn. It's very lightweight, etc. All these different forms of volcanism are, they're just not present on the moon. This idea that there's a perfect quarter inch or half inch layer of dust on the moon is absurd, absolutely absurd. So anyway, as entities, and we're talking private companies, try to go to the moon, doggone it, none of them can just quite make it there. The latest being, it's known as Peregrine. It was a private company that had a lunar landing mission set up. And a couple weeks ago, it was on its way to the moon, and bingo, it had all kinds of problems. A number of years ago, there was an XPRIZE associated with a landing on the moon. That was the XPRIZE. And one company was in process of actually doing this. They had a spacecraft built. They were Israeli, I think it was an Israeli private company. And they had NASA in charge of their telemetry. Well, as the spacecraft approached the moon and was inserted into lunar orbit, the spacecraft started dropping down out of lunar orbit. And all of a sudden, all these systems started to fail. The main retro rocket was failing, telecommunications, telemetry failing, other things were failing. And all of a sudden, so the engine shut off and the thing crashes into the moon and is a failure. The Peregrine, which was just the other day going towards the moon, it didn't hardly get out of Earth orbit. And then all of a sudden, the malfunction started there. And of course, because of the nature of telecommunications from a spacecraft in going out into deep space, what we would consider above Earth orbit or out there beyond Earth orbit, of course, they're going to have to depend on some government facilities of some kind to transmit the information, etc. But isn't it amazing that all of these systems, totally unrelated on the spacecraft, just like the Israeli mission during the XPRIZE, all of these unrelated systems start failing at the same time? Well, that doesn't make much sense. The probability that they're all going to fail at the same time, at the same location, and completely diverse systems, that the idea that they would all fail simultaneously is like, somebody's playing foul ball here. And then there was a third mission also, which failed, private mission. And so then the articles start coming out. And this is what kind of ground me the wrong way, just to be honest with you. NASA starts putting out these public relation articles going, see, NASA's the only one that can go to the moon. And it's, you know, and this is what drives me kind of crazy. And this is the same story that came out of the Challenger accident. Remember the teacher going up into space and boom, blows up, all the people dead, including the teacher. Every student in the country was watching that launch. Why that launch? Because the teacher in space program was coming to a culmination, and the teacher was on that space shuttle. So the students had chosen their teacher and written about why their teacher should be the teacher in space. So every school, private, public, whatever, charter schools, all were recommending their teacher to be the teacher in space. And they wrote in, submitted it, and went through this whole hullabaloo process where it was really widely publicized. Every student was aware of it. And then it comes down to, what's her name? Cindy McCullough, was that her name? Teacher on board, going up, the shuttle's going up, blam, big explosion, all dead. And what's the message? You can't go into space, public, only NASA can go into space. And they're doing it again on this moon deal. But NASA's got a little problem. The Apollo footage was done in a warehouse down in the American Southwest. And, you know, some people say, well, they went to the moon, but they only filmed what they showed the public in this warehouse. Well, the credibility problem starts to wear pretty thin there. But the real problem is that the lunar surface doesn't look like what we see in the Apollo film. And so if some other company or private entity gets to the moon, lands on the moon, and goes, hey, this don't look nothing like the Apollo footage, NASA's got a little credibility problem. Because now you've got a cross-reference from a third-party independent who's not verifying what NASA says that the moon looks like. So back to my title here. It's called the NASA Lunar Surface Credibility Problem. Now, let's dig a little bit deeper here. When NASA's plans to go back to the moon, allegedly back because there's no third-party independent verification that they went there in the first place. And that's why my official statement, by the way, which is on my webpage, which has been hacked, is that the NASA going to the moon, the Apollo program, is an unverified scientific claim. Because in the world of science, you don't get to verify your own claims. In the world of science, whether it's cold fusion, remember the cold fusion debacle, Franz and Fleischmann were their names, two guys, two chemists that had a cold fusion experiment going on in their laboratory. They go out to lunch, they come back, and the table's melted. And their little beaker of whatever it was they were doing was melted all over the floor. And they go, we've achieved cold fusion. They don't know what happened. They don't know why the table melted and all of this, their experiment all over the floor, and they couldn't reproduce it. But they went out and announced it, okay? So the scientific community comes back down on them really, really hard. It's like, no, the way you do science is you have to have you have to know what you did, first of all, and document it, give a process, then you have to hand it off, and other independent laboratories around the world can reproduce that. Now you're talking turkey. Now you got something. But until that happens, you don't have the third-party independent verification that you did something. For example, cold fusion. But something much bigger, potentially much bigger, the biggest scientific claim of the 20th century that NASA went to the moon is unverified. There's nobody else that has verified this. Now, I saw this clown, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and I call him a clown because that's what he is. He's a tier three spokesperson for everything standard science, is trying to convince a guy that NASA went to the moon. And so then he shows these high altitude, these orbiting photographs, allegedly of the Apollo landing sites, and a couple of pixels scratched into a photograph. Your cell phone could do better. And trying to convince the guy that NASA went to the moon because these NASA photographs of the lunar orbiter that was taking pictures of the alleged Apollo lunar landing sites. Well, first of all, NASA doesn't get to verify its own work. That's not how science works. It's got to be third-party independent. And NASA Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is part of NASA, managed by the University of Arizona, who are a bunch of lying astronomers. The astronomers, I will say in public, the astronomers at the University of Arizona are bald-faced liars. They were in charge of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And when that orbiter went up there, they announced it, pre-announced it for 6 years. We waited patiently for the results of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So we wait 6 years for this amazing Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter to produce the photographs of the Apollo lunar landing sites. And then when they're taken, the date of the orbit where they were going to be passing over the Apollo lunar landing sites, et cetera, comes and goes, and nothing. Nothing at all. And we wait, and then people start saying, hey, where are the big photos? Well, we're delaying the release of these a little bit. 6 months later, the photographs come out, and there are these photographs with the Apollo supposed lunar lander down there sitting on this, or the pod, because it's just the pod that's left, and the rover that's still there because they didn't haul that away, allegedly. But in just like two or three pixels. And then the line where the lunar rover drove this little path looked like somebody drew with a pencil line on the picture. That's what they, you know, and do you think that is the level of camera they put on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which was allegedly had such good optics that you could see small pebbles, because this was the plan for the next lunar landing that NASA was supposed to do. So that you would need to know detailed characteristics of the terrain if you're going to land there, right? That's what it was for. Yet the Apollo landers looked like one or two pixels scratched into the surface. That's what they present. And this is NASA itself. So number one, NASA doesn't get to verify its own scientific claims. Number two, it's garbage. Number three, they faked it. They faked the verification photos. Anyway, thank you, University of Arizona astronomers, for once again just lying to the public, covering it up. But now the Artemis mission of NASA is they're supposedly going to go back to the moon here shortly. It was supposed to be next year, then they postponed it to 2025. And I guarantee you it'll be postponed again. Was the guy's name Nelson just came out and said, yeah, we're going to postpone it a little bit. It'll be towards the end of the century, believe me. Okay, so anyway, be that as it may, the Artemis mission is going to go to the South Pole. They're not going to land anywhere near the alleged Apollo landing sites. Why? Because if they actually go there, they have this credibility problem that the footage they released to the public of the alleged Apollo lunar landings was faked in a warehouse in this quarter inch layer of dust, perfect, all over the lunar surface. It's not what the lunar surface looks like at all. So now they're saying, well, the surface of the moon at the South Pole is much more rugged. Isn't that kind of an admission that, why would the Apollo lunar landing sites look different? I mean, the hocus pocus here is getting pretty thick. So anyway, once again, back to my title, I call it the NASA Lunar Surface Credibility Problem. And it's only going to get worse. And it would really get worse overnight if a private company landed on the moon. So the three companies that have tried so far have failed. Very interesting. Okay. And I'm just going to mention a couple other little issues here with the lunar landing. These have come up since, and you've seen the videos with the whole laundry list of issues that dealing with Apollo lunar landing sites, and I've added a lot of these of my own. And these are questions. These are scientific questions. This is not badgering. This is, remember Pons and Fleischmann, when they just claimed to have had cold fusion, people jumped all over there. Oh, whew, it was horrible. It ruined their careers. But let's take a look at the Apollo landers. They come down. They got four legs. Land on the lunar surface. The lunar surface, even in the warehouse vision of the lunar surface, it's undulating. It's not flat, and it's undulating on a very short scale. So you're not going to find that, middle of the living room, flat, perfectly flat lunar surface. And so how do four legs, like if you take a chair that has perfect four legs and you set it on a floor that's very uneven, it's going to rock back and forth a little bit, right? It's not very good if you're trying to equipment managed in a lunar lander. Okay, so anyway, how does this lander with four legs, four stationary legs, come down and land on the moon? The way you'd really design it would be with three legs. And then it could land at any angle up to a certain degree so it doesn't fall over. Okay, so that's one issue. The second issue is a far more critical and subtle question. How does the lunar lander, the thing, the pod that sits on top of the base that actually lands on the moon, how does it get back up into orbit, into the same orbit? Not just orbit. Getting into orbit is one thing. Getting into the same orbit is another issue. Okay, so here's how it works. Imagine that the lunar, here's the way it works. The Apollo program was like this. You go to the moon. So the lunar lander's sitting there, but it's kittywampus a little bit. There's no way it's going to be perfectly vertical, like in a perfect living room floor setting. And so it's going to be kittywampus just a little bit. So it came down, it landed, and it's tilted now. When it takes off, it's got a single retro rocket, boom, that takes off. It's not going to be going up into the same plane, orbital plane, as the orbiter, which is orbiting the moon. So the scenario with the Apollo is it comes into lunar orbit, drops into lunar orbit, it's circling the moon. The lander breaks free, goes down, lands on the moon. Now it's expected to launch and come up into exactly that same plane. Now, one of the more difficult things to do in orbital dynamics is to change orbits, because you got to do it exactly when those two orbital planes cross, which is only twice, once on the near side, once on the far side, when these two orbits cross. So you got to fire a rocket exactly at that point to change the vector, the velocity vector, to be in the same one. And how do you do that? You know, these are technical problems that are almost impossible to solve, even in low Earth orbit, let alone in lunar orbit in 1969. Okay, so anyway, I'm going to jump off that topic. And of course, they never talk about radiation. So I'm jumping off that topic now. And something that's very important here, I'm just going to quick mention this. I was on John Moore's show. I was going to talk more about this, but I don't have enough time on tonight's show. I'll talk more in the future. But AI is coming along, and there's a big issue that's coming along, and you got to be aware of it. There's a woman, her name is Alice, and this is a giant PSYOPs program, I guarantee you. Just given the woman's name, Alice, remember Alice in the Looking Glass, Alice in Wonderland? They're making this world into a topsy-turvy world. Alice is going to marry her bot boyfriend. This is coming up in June, and this is going to be all over the place. Companies are selling companionship through computers where you would create your ideal boyfriend or girlfriend, and then they create this personality that is completely compatible with you, and it's affecting a lot of people who are lonely. So it's just driving an illness that is in the world today. You can live in the biggest city in the world and nobody talks to you. So anyway, that's coming up. And then it's going to get to the point where people are going to start to demand that their bot, artificial intelligence boyfriend or wife or husband should be allowed to vote. Okay, this is going to get crazy. So I'm just introducing that topic now. And I'm going to jump off of that topic onto the my main science topic tonight. I'm going to be talking about this myth of science. Now, I bet you if I asked 100,000 people on the street, where does the oxygen come from that you breathe? I bet you, unless they're just stupid and really don't know anything, which is the case with a lot of people today, especially educated in the public school system, but most would say that the air we breathe in oxygen, we breathe out carbon dioxide. How does that carbon dioxide get turned back into oxygen so we can breathe again? That would be done. Most people, 99.999%, would say the Amazon jungle, because this is what you've been taught. What I'm going to do is go through this tonight and teach you that that is complete garbage. couldn't possibly be true, is not true at all. Okay, so let's just take a look at the world in general and look at some numbers here. A very high percentage of the world's oxygen is in its atmosphere. And of course, it's in water, it's locked up in other chemicals. So oxygen is a major component of the atmosphere. It's about 20%. Let's just say that. Just use round numbers. 20% of our atmosphere, this 100-mile thick layer of gas that surrounds our planet that's held there by gravity, about 20% of that is oxygen in molecular form, O2. Carbon dioxide is 0.04%. Okay? Now, if you took all the carbon dioxide in the world, and this doesn't happen, by the way, if you took all of that and converted it back to oxygen, which the Amazon jungle could never do, you would not make a dent in the amount of oxygen available for us to breathe. So right off the surface, as if you peel back the very first onion layer of this scientific myth, it would be false. It would be just, I mean, it just couldn't work at all. Now let's look at some other factors here. Let's look at where the population of the world is. The vast majority of the population of the world lives in the Northern Hemisphere. The Amazon jungle is in South America, a portion of Eastern South America, in the Southern Hemisphere. When you breathe out carbon dioxide and you're living in New York City or Kansas City or Houston or wherever you are, Russia, Europe, Paris, you know, Scandinavia, Northern Hemisphere, how does that carbon dioxide get down to the Amazon jungle, down to the floor of the Amazon jungle, convert it into oxygen, and then how does that oxygen get back to you? So you can breathe it again up in the normal Northern Hemisphere. Well, it's like the water problem. Let me explain the water problem. You know, the people that say, well, we can't eat meat because cows drink too much water, and that water is needed down in the desert regions of South America. Excuse me, how do you get the water that the cows are drinking if you killed the cows and the cows don't drink water anymore? How do you get that water down to South America so it can grow some plants on a desertification area? Well, you can't. So you may as well let the cows drink it. But the logic that goes out when you have left, what would you call them? Leftist science, let's put it that way. It's emotional science. It's built on, oh my goodness, that cow is drinking water, but you need water down in South America. And so therefore we can't let these cows drink water anymore. Not when you peel back the very first onion layer, it doesn't make any sense, because the water that the cow is drinking out in the middle of Kansas or Oklahoma or wherever, you can't get that water down to South America where you're imagining it's needed, you know, to stop desertification or whatever it is. Okay, so the same thing happens with this idea that the Amazon jungle is somehow converting oxygen that we breathe. We're breathing native oxygen. And by the way, your automobile, when you drive up and down the road, your automobile is burning a lot more oxygen than the driver. Okay? That automobile or truck or whatever you're driving around is sucking oxygen and air, 20% oxygen, in, burning it with a fossil fuel, which is, should not be called fossil fuel, by the way. We should call it comet fuel, because that's where it came from, literally. The original source is comet tail fuel. But the fuel is being consumed and it's burning oxygen. And out comes the carbon oxygen components, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, etc. So how does that, from New York City, where you have a million cars in a given day burning up oxygen, atmospheric oxygen, How do you get that CO2 down to the Amazon jungle, get it converted to oxygen, and then back up to New York City where you can burn it again? Excuse me, boys and girls. It's not going to work. And now, one time, and this is a long time ago, I mean, I was a young person. I'm sitting in an airport, looking out the window at a completely frozen environment on a winter's day. You know, you look off in the distance, all the trees, there's not a leaf there. The trees are barren. There's, you know, there's no living plant matter at all of any kind for 6 to 8 months of the year. And then in springtime, it starts growing again. In about late September, the leaves dry up and they fall off the trees. That's called autumn. And all of the autumn colors, etc. So for probably about 8 months of the year, there is no plant life at all producing, taking the CO2, converting it back to oxygen. So here I am sitting in the airport and I'm going, you know, it doesn't make any sense that the plants are converting the oxygen, creating the oxygen from carbon dioxide that we breathe, because, hey, it ain't happening here. It's just not happening here. It's the way it is. And so then you peel out back that next onion layer and you think, okay, now I'm exhaling carbon dioxide in this building in the middle of the airport, in the middle of a cold winter zone. How does that CO2 get down to the Amazon jungle, down to the floor where the plants are growing, creates oxygen, and how does that oxygen get back up here so I can breathe it again? Well, boys and girls, it just doesn't make any sense at all. Then you go back to the original statement that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is minuscule, absolutely minuscule. 20% oxygen in the atmosphere, 0.04% carbon dioxide. It's the numbers just aren't there. If you had 10% CO2 in the atmosphere, then you might make a case for that. But at 0.04% of the atmosphere being CO2, it's just not there. So we are using native oxygen from the atmosphere to fuel the people, the cows, the squirrels, you know, the worms, the fish in the water, etc., because that oxygen has to be renewed. Fish need oxygen, and if you haven't noticed, if you've got a fish tank at home, then the fish, you have to have a little pump in there that pumps air into the tank so that it keeps the water oxygenated, because the fish use it up pretty quickly. Or if you have, say, a pond. But how does it happen in nature? Well, you have waves which rustle the surface and recapture oxygen to put it in the water. If it's in a mountain stream, that water is cascading down a mountain stream and splashing around and picking up oxygen so that the trout that live in the stream can breathe. So the oxygen in the water, for example, has to be renewed. Otherwise, the fish would use it up and they'd all die. So there are processes, natural processes, that do that, that take the place of the little air pump that you have in your tank at home. But in the air, there is no replenishing source of oxygen. But wait a minute, is there? And the answer is yes. The Earth is taking on material all the time, including water. This has been measured. Lou Frank, thank you, Lou, for being a real powerful scientist. University of Iowa put UV detectors on satellites. He actually was able to sneak them onto a satellite because he was refused government money, and discovered that water is coming into our atmosphere all the time. And of course, NASA can't explain why that is, because their theories don't account for things coming into the atmosphere. They thought they were little micro comets, little dirty snowballs. But the problem is that the water appears in vast regions over the surface of the outer atmosphere. And so this has been proven. And so along with this is coming oxygen, hydrogen, forming water. And those molecules of oxygen also form all kinds of other components, including diatomic or molecular oxygen. So the world is being replenished by oxygen from outer space, at a constant level, and it's constantly growing, but it's very minuscule. And one time I was in a scientific conference talking about this, and a guy stands up, he says, "Well, what's happening to all this water?" Well, the answer is that when it comes into the atmosphere, it falls down into the atmosphere, whether it comes down at night as the atmosphere cools and the water comes out of the otherwise dry atmosphere, or if it rains down, however it gets down to the surface, there are hydrological cycles that when the water evaporates, it moves northward in the northern hemisphere, and it moves southward in the southern hemisphere. The same thing that causes the wind patterns. And then it rises again and it rains or comes down as snow and then moves north again. This cycle continues until that water is deposited at the north and south pole as ice where it stays there. Okay, so anyway, but a lot of it comes in the form of oxygen. So our atmosphere is constantly being replenished with oxygen from outside the planet. Very simple, and it fits with my model of how the planets work. The planets are acting as comets, drawing in this material from outer space because the Earth is discharging the solar capacitor. Okay, so anyway, I've got about a couple minutes left here. I just want to remind you that my MR5 whole house water filters are on sale. They're a greatly reduced price. Typically, if you bought the components separately, the MR5, the UV sterilizer, and the extra pack of filter elements, they would total $2,380. So the best deal, which is the combination of those, the MR5, the sterilizer, and the extra pack of filter elements for the MR5, normally is $2,380, $200 off. Right now, it's another $800 off. For $1,580, and that literally $800 that you're going to save in this sale is going to more than pay for your plumber to install it. So go there right now, the webpage jmccwaterfilters.com, and yes, I get to do a little selfless promotion here on my radio show because, by the way, just to let you know, this commercial-free show has no sponsors. I don't get government money. There's no other source of income for me. I pay for my own airtime. That comes from you people purchasing products, and I don't take donations. So you're not sending me money and, you know, not getting something. You're getting the best water filter products in the world. I also sell the amazing stainless steel sink filter and then, of course, the replacement filter elements for the Berkey type of stainless steel gravity water filters. Once again, jmccwaterfilters.com. And I'm out of here. We'll talk to you next week. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.